Buon pomeriggio, sono Juan Carlos De Martin e sono uno dei due curatori di Biennale Tecnologia, l'altro essendo l'amico Luca De Biase, e sono qui a presentarvi un incontro eccezionale e veramente un grandissimo piacere con cui vi presento il nostro ospite collegato da New York City. Parlo del professor Jeffrey Sachs, che è uno dei più grandi economisti al mondo. Autore di libri molto diffusi, molto importanti, un importante educatore, un leader nello sviluppo sostenibile. E in questo momento lui serve come direttore del Centro per lo Sviluppo Sostenibile della Columbia University, dove è University Professor. Ha anche un ruolo importante con le Nazioni Unite, perché è il presidente del UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network e fa parte anche della UN Broadband Commission for Development. Ed è anche un assistente al segretario generale Antonio Guterres, così come era stato anche per precedenti segretari generali delle Nazioni Unite. I suoi libri hanno un'influenza in tutto il mondo, tradotti anche in italiano, tra l'altro, e ne cito soltanto alcuni che sono quelli più direttamente connessi al tema di Biennale, perché ha scritto un libro importante sull'età dello sviluppo sostenibile nel 2015. Nel 2017 ha scritto Building the New American Economy, quindi costruire una nuova economia americana. Smart, equa e sostenibile 2017, e poi da ultimo, l'ultimissimo libro, Le età della globalizzazione, geografia, tecnologia e istituzioni. E anche qua vediamo come la parola tecnologia, che ha il cuore di questa biennale, ritorni. Ha ricevuto 24 lauree honoris causa e premi di vario tipo, è considerato semplicemente uno dei più grandi economisti viventi e tra le persone più influenti al mondo. E prima di unirsi a Columbia è stato per più di 20 anni professore alla Harvard University. E per noi è particolarmente importante ospitarlo, non soltanto perché è appunto un leader e uno studioso di altissimo livello, ma anche perché è difficile pensare a qualcuno più autorevole per parlare del tema a cui tutta l'intera biennale è dedicata, che è il tema della sostenibilità. Per questo do il benvenuto al professor Sachs e do a lui il microfono. Grazie.
Juan Carlos, thank you very much. And thanks to the Politecnico di Torino for this whole wonderful conference and for honoring me to let me join you because it's really a very important time and a pleasure to be with you. You've asked me to speak about the challenges of technology and sustainable development in line with the theme of technology and humanity. And I think it's completely appropriate that technology is put at the center stage. It is probably the most fundamental driver of global change, the most fundamental source of our hopes for the future, and the most fundamental source of our headaches as well, because technology almost inevitably has two sides to it. The ability to do more things better, and alongside that, the ability to destroy things faster or to divide society more deeply. And this is the irony of technological change, this fundamental change driver of global change that has the beneficial and the perverse sides to it. And we're experiencing that once again. My guru, my teacher at Harvard University, the great biologist Edward Wilson, has a very nice expression, a very poignant expression. He says, "We have entered the 21st century with our Stone Age emotions, our medieval institutions, and our godlike technology." And I think that this is extremely important for us to reflect upon. By Stone Age emotions, Edward Wilson, as an evolutionary biologist, means that our basic human nature comes to us from 50,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago. We are products of evolution. This forged our basic biological makeup and our basic psychological makeup as well. How we cooperate or fail to cooperate, how we are forming our identity within groups, but how we also form hatreds across groups. Our medieval institutions, of course, are the cultural institutions and our political institutions that we rely on to address our common challenges. In the case of the United States, our Constitution was negotiated in the year 1787 in a conference in Philadelphia. Well, that means that we are more than 230 years with the same basic structure, and it doesn't work all that well. And we see that now day by day in the U.S. We're in a profound political crisis. And I would say it's a crisis that reflects the fact that the Constitution is no longer adequate to our realities, our technological realities, economic realities, demographic realities, nor does our Constitution take advantage of new technologies like the digital age. When it comes to this third dimension of Edward Wilson's phrase, Stone Age emotions, medieval institutions, godlike technologies, we are the heirs, we are the beneficiaries, as it were, of now more than 250 years of dramatic technological advances based on the modern sciences and the modern engineering. And what has been accomplished and continues to be accomplished in technological advance is beyond anything remotely experienced before the start of the Industrial Revolution. And one feels that the pace of technological advance continues to accelerate. And on the whole, this means the opportunity for better lives, for longer lives, for more fulfilling lives, if these technologies are used for the human good. But every major technology that I know of has its positives and its negative sides. And because of our Stone Age emotions and our medieval institutions, we're not so good at harnessing the positive side of the technologies without also giving rise to the negative forces of these technologies. And that is the existential dilemma of humanity. How can we harness our know-how for the good and put aside or suppress all of the damage? Consider just as some basic ideas in this regard, and then I'll turn to the current circumstance. The Industrial Revolution, which began in the early 19th century, or perhaps late 18th century in England, was powered by one basic invention, which then gave rise to a cascade of inventions. And that basic invention was the steam engine, which enabled us to harness the fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, for the first time in human history at a large scale for motive power, to move things, to move vehicles, to move rail, to move ocean steamers, to move machinery in factories. And that created the Industrial Age. But about 100 years after the steam engine was brought to widespread use, scientists discovered that burning coal had the side effect of changing the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide. And by the 1890s, it was understood that that would warm the planet as carbon dioxide concentrations increased. In 1896, Svante Arrhenius, the Swedish Nobel laureate chemist, made the correct calculations of global warming. Now we are 125 years after Arrhenius's calculations, but we still do not have the global warming under control. And so we have that powerful technological breakthrough, the use of fossil fuels. We do not have the wisdom to control the side effects of this fossil fuel. And this is exemplary of our challenges of technology more generally. Think of the atomic age. Quantum mechanics brought us great advances of technology, but of course brought us nuclear weapons as well as nuclear energy. And we are still struggling to avoid planetary self-destruction because there are 6,000 nuclear warheads in the United States, a country that is able to produce 6,000 nuclear warheads and also a president as mentally deranged as Donald Trump. It's a bad combination. And this is another reflection of this perverse fact. Now we are in yet another surge of technology, digital technology, which is as fundamental as the steam engine and as fundamental as nuclear energy and power. Because the digital technology means that every kind of information can now be converted to the sequences of zeros and ones first envisioned by Alan Turing in 1936 in his universal computer, and now brought to reality in modern computation, in modern data transmission through fiber and microwaves, so that now we are in a digital age where these technologies that we're using, of course, for this conference itself, are fundamentally transforming our societies. You might say, what could go wrong with the digital technology? It gives us the ability to stream movies, to video conference together, to exchange data, to collect real-time information. But of course, it also gives us cyber warfare. It gives us loss of privacy. It gives us state surveillance. It gives us space wars. It gives us potential devastating attacks on infrastructure. And so yet again, we are faced with a technology that is very empowering, but is also very threatening for us. And yet we have Stone Age emotions and medieval institutions to try to grapple with this dual reality. All of these technologies also lead to imbalances of power. They produce great wealth, but they also produce great imbalances of wealth. They also immiserize or make poorer parts of the population. So no technological advance that I know of uniformly raises everybody's incomes automatically. Usually some parts of society benefit while other parts of society lose. We know this from the Industrial Revolution onward, that when mechanization occurred for the first time, say in the textile sector, millions of people lost their livelihoods in India, and certainly vast numbers in Europe from the mechanization of the looms and the spinning wheels and the other activities that used to be the rural occupation for a tremendous part of the population. So advances like the steam engine or electrification or artificial intelligence and robotics raise the wealth of some parts of society, but absolutely devastate other parts of society. This is one of the fundamental realities of our time. In the advanced economies, the digital age has meant higher incomes for well-educated people with advanced training who can be empowered by the digital economies. As a knowledge worker, so-called, I use, and all of us use computers by the moment, round the clock. Our research is, in my case, as an academic, greatly empowered. My incomes, my security, my productivity improved. But at the same time, this very same technology has led to mass automation in manufacturing. And that has raised the productivity of the workforce so much that it has led to a significant loss of jobs of workers with high school educations who used to be in the middle class of the economy and now can't find work because they have been replaced by the digital era, by the machines, by artificial intelligence, remote sensing, robotics, and so forth. So technologies create upheaval. They create geopolitical tensions. They create imbalances of power, and they create widening inequalities of wealth and income. And we now need to face all of these challenges together. So if we look to the present day, with our pandemic now, but even more generally to our environmental crises of climate change, loss of biodiversity, massive pollution. We look to our geopolitical challenges of cyber warfare, of an arms race in space, of growing geopolitical competition that is very threatening, and China. And if we look to the widening inequalities of wealth and income in our society, especially along educational divides, those with advanced degrees and those who, for whatever life circumstance, have educational attainment, usually of secondary school, but not higher, we have become highly divided societies. And COVID has accelerated these differences. In fact, this year, the wealthy have gotten vastly wealthier than ever before, whereas large parts of the world population have been impoverished. If you take the list of the 500 richest people in the world, they have now combined net worth, just 500 people, of $7 trillion. And their wealth has gone up since January 1st by $1 trillion in a year of crisis, because the world moved online so that the owners of the online technologies and systems, like Jeffrey Bezos of Amazon or Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, or Bill Gates of Microsoft, have had vast increases of wealth because they own shares of these companies, whereas tens of millions of people have been left destitute by these technologies. Now, one would say digital technology is very empowering. It raises overall social being. It's true, but it does not do so evenly. And because of that, it can also give rise to tremendous tensions. And just like the nuclear energy, now we have a kind of arms race in artificial intelligence and in the digital economy, where the United States is trying to stop China's development of its digital excellence by trying to cut China off from the supply of advanced microchips. It won't work, but this is the example of Stone Age thinking and medieval institutions in the face of godlike technologies. The American military planners are trying to stop China from advancing. It's absurd and dangerous, but it is true right now and very worrisome to me. If I put all of these issues together, I come to the concept of sustainable development. Why? Because sustainable development is an idea that we should harness the technological advances to raise material well-being in a fair way and with environmental sustainability. So the idea is prosperity, social justice, and environmental sustainability combined. The reason that sustainable development is an objective rather than a reality is that our economic system does not by itself produce a sustainable development outcome. Our economic systems, for many reasons that people know, give the wrong incentives or lead to inequalities of wealth that are inconsistent with the normative objectives of sustainable development. Our socioeconomic system worldwide, which is largely a capitalist market-based system, is quite good at producing wealth. It's quite good at spurring technology, but it is very bad at protecting the environment. It is very bad at social justice, and it is very bad at ensuring peace, because it leads to inequalities of power and it leads to arms races. And so we end up with threats of war and with many conflicts and wars of conquest. My country, the United States, has been the leading military power and the leading empire of the last 50 years. It's created more wars. It's overthrown more governments than any other country. And that is a reflection of its technological power, but it's been used very dangerously and very destructively, including self-destructively. So sustainable development is an idea to harness a moral framework so that our technologies are used for the global human good rather than for the particular interests of power and wealth of a small group, and so that these technologies are used in an environmentally sustainable manner rather than used to extract maximum capital from nature at the expense of future generations. It's a big challenge because our mindsets are limited. We're not good at global thinking. We're good at America first, the idiotic idea of our idiotic president. We're not good at humanity first. And we are not good at overcoming the short-term power and greed of the corporate world that we have created to restrain it from environmental destruction, even I would say environmental self-destruction. So because of this, the world system, the geopolitical and socioeconomic systems do not lead to the outcomes that we want when we take a reflective, ethical perspective. And therefore, we have to think systematically about how to transform the socioeconomic institutions, how to update our constitutions, how to update our regulatory outlook, how to compensate for our Stone Age emotions in ways that can produce the common good. And the two most important paths that we have selected for that at the geopolitical level are through the United Nations. One is to adopt the Sustainable Development Goals as 17 objectives that every country in the world should pursue in order to redirect our economies so that they are not only productive, but also inclusive and also sustainable, and to do that in a globally cooperative manner. And our second agreement is the environmental treaties, notably the Paris Climate Agreement and the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity to protect nature. And so we've created a framework that is not a plan, but is a set of global aspirations to redirect our societies towards sustainable development. But then they're put in the hands of politicians. And in the hands of Donald Trump, these words are meaningless because Trump pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement. He completely despised or didn't even know of the Sustainable Development Goals. He never used the phrase in his term in office. He's a psychopath, in my opinion, so it's understandable that he didn't, but it has been highly destructive. So we have globally objectives that make sense, that are morally sound. We have moral guidance from our greatest moral leaders of our age, Pope Francis being the most important moral figure for the whole planet. And then we have our medieval institutions of government that we need to make work for the sake of using these technologies in an inclusive and sustainable manner. Now, there's a lot to be said, and we don't have the time to say it right now, at a technical level of how to achieve these goals. In other words, from a technical, economic, technocratic, engineering point of view, what should we do? And I could give an example for climate change. We need to transform the energy system from its reliance on coal, oil, and natural gas to reliance on wind, solar, hydro, and geothermal energy, excuse me. So we need to move to zero carbon energy, and we need to transform our vehicles from internal combustions to electric vehicles, and so forth. These are the technical solutions. We need the Politecnico di Torino to help on the technical pathways for this. But then we need our political and our regulatory structures to direct these changes. For instance, our utility companies that produce, generate power and distribute electricity, like Enel, need to be in a framework that all of the energy that Enel is going to be distributing will be zero carbon energy. And fortunately, Enel, it's a great company. It understands very well that that is the direction we're moving, and it's actually leading such solutions. But this has to be done every place in the world. We need similar solutions for other parts of the economy. We need to face up to the education crisis and the income crisis. We need systems of labor regulation to ensure that all workers have decent jobs with enough leisure time, vacation time, health coverage, protection, and so forth, that they can live decent lives of dignity. we have enough wealth and income in our societies to do that, but it requires redistribution, not simply market forces. So I take the point of view that we start with our moral framework of the Sustainable Development Goals, the Paris Climate Agreement, the Convention on Biological Diversity to protect the biodiversity. And then as specialists, I'm an economist, you're engineers and other fields, we work on the practical pathways that can transform our economies to take the benefits of the technological advances while restraining the negative externalities and protecting us from the depredations of arms races and greed and all of the other forces that we know are very real that can derail our hopes for sustainable development. Let me conclude by noting that we have some chance to make progress in 2021. 2020 was a horrible year. 2020 was the year of COVID-19. Italy has suffered 48,000 deaths. The United States has suffered 242,000 deaths from COVID. The epidemic is raging in both of our countries as we speak because the public health was not properly implemented. We know that in Asia, the epidemic is largely under control in China, in Korea, in Australia and New Zealand, but not in Europe and the United States. So 2020 was a very bad year, except we'll look back. One good part of 2020 was we got rid of Trump in the election because he was probably the single biggest threat on the planet and certainly the biggest threat to the United States to get back on track. And now he is going, thanks God. 2021 can be the year in which the pandemic is really controlled, because Europe and the United States could do what the Asia-Pacific countries have done through public health to suppress the virus. We will also have new vaccines coming online, which will be an enormous benefit. But beyond stopping the virus, we can pursue sustainable development. Europe will launch the European Green Deal. Joe Biden will launch an equivalent Green Deal for the United States. China, Japan, and Korea have all announced very recently the commitment to move to a zero carbon energy system more decisively. The world's governments will meet in Glasgow in November at so-called COP26, the Conference of the Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And this can be the time that all of our countries commit to decarbonizing the energy system to escape finally from this dire wrong direction of worsening climate change. And we can take the benefits that we have learned from the digital technology this year and share them widely. So this year, half the economy went online. Those of us lucky to be part of the online economy have done well. We've kept our jobs, we've kept our incomes, we've kept our activities, but part of the economy has suffered. Children who don't have access to the internet, who could not be in online school. Citizens who don't have access, who could not partake of telemedicine or government services. So we need to also use 2021 as the breakthrough year for social justice and social inclusion, to say that this new digital age will be an era for all people to join. with all of the wealth in the big technology companies, with all of the reach of the telecommunications industry, it is absolutely practical to ensure that everybody is online and trained and able to use the benefits of these technologies. And it is absolutely within the human condition that Europe, the United States, China, and others could create an international legal framework to use the digital technologies for the good rather than for the arming of space and the acceleration of cyber warfare capacities. So this is my hope and my belief sustainable development is our guide to how to reform our economies. We have solutions within technological reach. We need to make our own emotions and our institutions work for the common good. Thank you very much for letting me be with you.
Grazie, Professor Sachs, per questa straordinaria lezione, davvero illuminante, uno dei punti alti di questa manifestazione che stiamo organizzando qua a Torino. Grazie davvero. E le rubiamo ancora qualche minuto per porle qualche domanda, due o tre domande che vengono dal pubblico. E se mi permette, comincio con una domanda personale mia, perché lei ha parlato, giustamente ha ricordato la Cina, e recentemente abbiamo letto che il presidente cinese Xi Jinping ha annunciato che la Cina raggiungerà la neutralità rispetto al carbone entro il 2060. Ritiene che sia uno sviluppo importante, serio, o soltanto un annuncio politico a effetto?
This is a very important development, and it is, in my view, the result of European diplomatic leadership. In fact, it followed literally EU-China discussions, because Europe's leaders pressed President Xi, take this pledge, make this commitment, just like Europe has done in the European Green Deal. And for those of us who work with the Chinese colleagues, I can tell you this is real, because when President Xi Jinping makes a commitment like this in the General Assembly, you see a flurry of activity throughout the society. Almost within, I would say, 3 or 4 weeks, I started receiving documents from China showing technical analysis of how the new goal can be achieved by leading specialists at the universities. Because in China's system, when the president gives a signal, others listen and start responding. Or maybe one could say that, and more true, there was a lot of discussion underway, and President Xi and the leadership became convinced of the feasibility of this goal. And then, as soon as the goal was enunciated, we see more mention of it in many academic processes. Next year is also the start of the 14th five-year plan, and I would expect to see an acceleration of investments in renewable energy as a key part of this plan. I'm also trying to emphasize in every way that I can that China's Belt and Road Initiative, of which Italy is a part, and I think properly so, should also insist on being a green zero carbon initiative. In other words, all of the investments under the Belt and Road umbrella should be for renewable energy based technologies rather than fossil fuel technologies. So my answer is yes, this is real. Prime Minister Suga of Japan followed President Xi Jinping's announcement a couple of weeks afterwards by announcing that Japan would reach net zero emissions by 2050. Very good sign. I think all of us are coming to understand that we have to be leaders of technology as part of a world change, or else our industries will be left behind. The auto industry in Europe needs quickly to move to electric vehicles. because that will be the vehicles that will be driving in the future. And if any major company says, no, I don't believe in that, I want to continue with internal combustion engines, they will lose their market share dramatically in the 2030s, maybe even sooner. So I think that this is very real. I am urging that China advance its commitment to 2050, because the climate science tells us that we need to decarbonize not by 2060, but by 2050. But China's announcement to reach 2060 is already causing the emissions curves in China's planning to be accelerated. And I think we can even push China, when the United States makes such a pledge, to reach the decarbonization by mid-century, not a decade later.
Grazie molte. Provo a unire insieme alcune delle domande che sono arrivate nella chat. Vedo che molti sono rimasti colpiti dalla sua citazione del professor Wilson sulle istituzioni medievali e sulle emozioni primordiali dell'età della pietra. E chiedono cosa possiamo fare sia riguardo le emozioni, ammesso si possa fare qualcosa, sia riguardo le istituzioni, dove almeno in linea di principio potremmo fare qualcosa.
So on emotions, I would say all of Western, or not all, but most of Western ethical thinking, starting with Aristotle, actually starting at least with Socrates, Plato and Aristotle, reflected on this question very deeply. Of course, they didn't know Darwinian evolution, but they did have a remarkable sense of human nature. They understood that we are driven by multiple and often competing impulses. And the ancient Greek philosophers said that our psyches are divided into three parts, the vegetative part, which was for nutrition and reproduction, like plants, our animal part, which was for motion and perception and short-term desire and movement, and our rational part of our psyche. Now, in modern neuroscience, we actually also have similar divisions, but we call them brain networks. So we talk about the executive control function of the prefrontal cortex. We talk about the amygdala and nucleus accumbens systems of subcortical choice and reflex, and so forth. And we understand that we are built by evolution to have competing impulses. And the idea of ethics is that as divided psyches, as divided individuals, we learn to cultivate the desirable sides of our mental apparatus. That's the basic idea of Aristotelian ethics. It goes back 2,300 years. So it says we're a mix of good and bad, but we need to learn to cultivate the good. And how do we do that? By knowing ourselves, which was the great Socratic injunction, actually at the Temple of Delphi, which said, know thyself. And this, I think, is absolutely correct and in line with cognitive behavioral therapy today, which is that if we know we have Stone Age emotions, what are they? Well, one is that we jump for the short-term gain, not for the long-term benefit. So we learn to train ourselves in what the ancient Greeks called phronesis, or practical wisdom, to take the longer term, what they called forbearance, what we now call time discounting, to look for the long term rather than for the short term, to cultivate the virtue of temperance, which is a moderation, which of course was Aristotle's great character trait that he championed, to be moderate and under self-control. We also understand that psychologically we are primed to hate the other tribe. And so when Americans are told the Chinese are evil, that is playing on a medieval, playing on a Stone Age emotion, that if they don't look like us, they are subhuman, or we should hate them, or they are our enemy. It's amazing how easy it is to provoke the us versus them mentality. So I believe that the field of ethics is our self-help manual to manage our Stone Age emotions so that we don't kill ourselves, that we respect the universality of humanity, that we respect universal human dignity, that we understand that we are very flawed creatures that have developed in the course of evolution to have multiple brain pathways that give us all sorts of conflicting tendencies. And I tend to side with Aristotle to believe that we need to foster our rational side. So I'm a rationalist philosophical spirit, believing that it's not through emotion, certainly not through emotion primarily, but it's through thinking clearly and rationally. But of course, emotion is part of clear thinking, that we cultivate the good meaning what is desirable for humanity, not for our short-term reflexive interest. When it comes to our institutions, there we have to be creative as well. Of course, our institutions should be designed in light of our human nature. One of the advances of institutions from Montesquieu onward was to reflect on the fact that since we are these imperfect beings, we need institutions that that enable us to stay safe despite our imperfections. So we put in checks and balances so that we don't have despots. And it's interesting, the American system was almost taken over by Trump. He's a mentally ill man, in my opinion, truly psychopathic. But our institutions were almost overtaken by him. We're not done with the story, but I think he'll go and Biden will become president. But then we have to strengthen our institutions so that another madman doesn't come along and do the same thing. But I would say we can go farther than that now. With digital technology, we ought to be able to move to a kind of digital deliberation and digital democracy. We ought to be able to participate as citizens. I call it, instead of going to the Agora of Athens, where a few thousand men went in 400 BC to listen to Pericles, now we could have an e-Agora. We could go online together to deliberate. And so we should be creative, using our technologies to find new ways of participation, new ways to channel and to cultivate information, new ways to expose fraud, fake news, and new ways to develop learning and shared understanding. So institutional change is also a target that we should have in mind. And I would say digital democracy is a real possibility, and we should be experimenting with that, as many places are, but I'd like to see the experiments in more places of how we can use the digital world for deliberative democracy.
Grazie molto. Un'ultima domanda posta da un ascoltatore, e poi la ringraziamo per il suo tempo. La domanda è la seguente. Per andare nella direzione che lei ha esposto nella sua lezione, pensa che andranno riviste le catene del valore globale, ovvero che si andrà verso produzioni più locali, più nazionali o più per aree geografiche, oppure una correlazione spuria, che non debole? Cosa ne pensa?
Well, I think that globalization is an ethical good, first of all. It's not true that we want to close up, because by having a global reach, we really can have a broader sharing across humanity. We can have more understanding of each other. We can trade with each other. We can learn from each other's cultures. So I regard globalization first not as a bad per se. I regard it as an ethical, desirable reality. But that doesn't mean that all forms of interconnection are good, because globalization brings pandemics, it brings war, it brings spillovers of environmental harm, and so on. I say that globalization is an ethical good if it is designed for the common good of humanity. So that means that our international institutions need to be properly shaped, just like our national institutions. This is the 75th year of the United Nations. I'm, of course, a huge fan of the United Nations, and I spend a lot of my life working for the United Nations and believe in it very much. And I believe both in the UN Charter, which is the legal framework, and in the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the kind of moral charter of the global system, and which starts out with the concept of universal human dignity. So I think that globalization, we should aim for it, not aim to live behind our borders, even if we could. We could not. But even if we could, I would say we should not try to. And I would point you to Pope Francis's new encyclical, Fratelli Tutti, which is built around the parable of the Good Samaritan, which emphasizes that the encounter with the other is a moral force for the human good. And I think that globalization enables us to do that. Now, having said that, there are so many problems. Global value chains can be, first of all, a threat to national security. They can be a source of environmental destabilization, because say that a company buys a product that is produced in an environmentally unstable, unsustainable way from the Amazon or from the Indonesian rainforest, then the global value chain is actually a destructive force, not a constructive force. So we need to put the global interconnections, the supply chains, under the framework of sustainable development. I believe that every company should be required to understand its global supply chain. Where are my products coming from? If I'm buying soybeans, is that coming from an area of deforestation of the Amazon? If I'm buying palm oil, is that coming from the destruction of the orangutan habitat in Sabah and Sarawak, Malaysia, for example? We need to know these things. But again, with digital technologies, we can track every commodity with barcode across the world as it makes its way, to ensure that as consumers, we're consuming in a supply chain that is sustainable from the upstream all the way to the final use. So in this sense, globalization needs a lot of reform, but it is an enabler of the human good if it is carried out in the right way. It also requires, just like within Europe, the big debate, should there be a transfer system within Europe? And of course, I say yes. Stronger regions should help weaker regions. And some of that was negotiated this time in the European budget. We need a similar kind of philosophy at the global scale, that there is more redistribution from some of those 500 billionaires, for example, to the poorest people in the world, so that the world as a whole is operating on the principles of solidarity and social justice.
Professor Sachs, grazie veramente per questa straordinaria lezione e per le risposte a queste domande. È stato veramente un onore e un piacere ospitarla a Biennale Tecnologia. Grazie molto e speriamo di rivederla alla prossima edizione. Grazie.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.